It's a funny place to choose. I expect it's for the sake of the coolness. I reached the office door and turned out the lights in the garden. I heard Mr. Smith say, "Look there, dear, that white house with the dome. That must be the palace." Martha said, "A beggar asleep in the pool?" "It does happen. I never noticed him. What are you looking for?" "My paperweight. Why should anyone take my paperweight?"
"What did it look like?"
"A little coffin with R.I.P. stamped on it. I used it for non-urgent mail." She laughed and held me still and kissed me. I responded as well as I could, but the corpse in the pool seemed to turn our preoccupations into comedy. The corpse of Dr. Philpott belonged to a more tragic theme. We were only a subplot, affording a little light relief. I heard Joseph move in the bar and called to him, "What are you doing?" Apparently Mrs. Smith had explained their needs to him. 2 cups, 2 spoons, a bottle of hot water. "Add a blanket," I said, "and then get moving to the town."
"When shall I see you again?" Martha asked.
"The same place, the same time."
"Nothing has changed, has it?" she asked me with anxiety.
"No, nothing." But my tone had an edge to it, which she noticed.
"I'm sorry, but all the same you've come back."
When at last she drove away with Joseph, I went back to the pool and sat on its edge in the dark. I was afraid the Smiths might come downstairs and make conversation, but I had been waiting only a few minutes by the pool when I saw the lights go out in the John Barrymore suite. They must have taken the Yeastrol and the Barmine, and they had now lain down to their untroubled sleep. Last night the festivities had kept them up late, and it had been a long day. I wondered what had happened to Jones. He had expressed his intention of staying at the Trianon. I thought, too, of Mr. Fernandez and his mysterious tears. Anything rather than think of the Secretary for Social Welfare coiled up under the diving board. Far up in the mountains beyond Kenskoff, a drum beat, marking the spot of a voodoo tonnel. It was not often one heard the drums now, under Papa Doc's rule. Something padded through the dark, and when I turned on my torch, I saw a thin, starved dog poised by the diving board. It looked at me with dripping eyes and wagged a hopeless tail, as though it were asking my permission to jump down and lick the blood. I shooed it away. A few years ago I had employed 3 gardeners, 2 cooks, Joseph, an extra barman, 4 boys, 2 girls, a chauffeur, and in the season, it was not yet the end of the season, I would have taken on extra help. Tonight by the pool there would have been a cabaret, and in the intervals of the music I would have heard the perpetual murmur of the distant streets, like a busy hive. Now, even though the curfew had been lifted, there was not a sound, and without a moon not even a dog barked. It was as though my success had gone out of earshot, too. I had not known it for very long, but I could hardly complain. There were 2 guests in the Hotel Trianon. I had found my mistress again, and unlike Monsieur le Ministre, I was still alive. I settled myself as comfortably as I could on the edge of the pool and began my long wait for Dr. Maggio.
Chapter 3 1 From time to time in my life, I had found it necessary to provide a curriculum vitae. It usually began something like this. Born 1906 at Monte Carlo of British parents. Educated at the Jesuit College of the Visitation. Many prizes for Latin verse and Latin prose composition. Embarked early on a business career. Of course, I varied the details of that career according to the recipient of the curriculum. What a lot, too, was left out, or was of doubtful truth, in even those opening statements. My mother was certainly not British, and to this day I am uncertain whether she was French. Perhaps she was a rare Monegasque. The man she had chosen for my father left Monte Carlo before my birth. Perhaps his name was Brown. There is a ring of truth in the name Brown. She wasn't usually so modest in her choice.
The last time I saw her, when she was dying in Port-au-Prince, she bore the name of the Comtesse de Lascaux-Villiers. She had left Monte Carlo, and incidentally her son, hurriedly, soon after the armistice of 1918, with my bills at the college unsettled. But the Society of Jesus is used to unsettled bills. It works assiduously on the fringe of the aristocracy, where return checks are almost as common as adulteries. And so the college continued to support me. I was a prize pupil, and it was half expected that I would prove in time to have a vocation. I even believed it myself. The sense of vocation hung around me like the grip, a miasma of unreality, at a temperature below normal in the cool, rational morning, but a fever heat at night. As other boys fought with the demon of masturbation, I fought with faith. I find it strange to think now of my Latin verses and compositions. All that knowledge has vanished as completely as my father. Only one line has obstinately stuck in my head, a memory of the old dreams and ambitions. Exegi monumentum ere perennius. I said it to myself nearly 40 years later, when I stood, on the day of my mother's death, by the bathing pool of the Hotel Trianon in Pétionville, and looked up at the fantastic tracery of woodwork against the palms and the inky storm clouds blowing over Kenskov. I more than half owned the place, and knew that soon I would own it all. I was already in possession, a man of property. I remember thinking, I am going to make this the most popular tourist hotel in the Caribbean. And perhaps I might have succeeded if a mad doctor had not come to power and filled our nights with the discords of violence instead of jazz. The career of an hotelier was not, as I have indicated, the one which the Jesuits had expected me to follow. That had been finally wrecked by a college performance of Romeo and Juliet in its very staid French translation. I was given the part of the aged Friar Lawrence, and some of the lines I had to learn have remained with me to this day, I don't know why. They hardly have the ring of poetry. Accorde-moi de discuter ce temps et ta. Frère Laurent had the power of making even the tragedy of the star-crossed lovers prosaic. J'apprends que tu dois, et rien ne peut le reculer, être marié à ce compte jeudi prochain. The part must have seemed to the good fathers a suitable one, under the circumstances, and not too exciting or exacting. But I think my vocational grip was already very nearly over, and the interminable rehearsals, the continual presence of the lovers, and the sensuality of their passion, however muted by the French translator, led me to my breakout. I looked a good deal older than my age, and the dramatic director, if he could not make me an actor, had at least taught me adequately enough the secrets of make-up. I borrowed the passport of a young lay professor of English literature and bluffed my way one afternoon into the casino. There, in the surprising space of 45 minutes, due to an unlikely run of 19s and 0s, I gained the equivalent of £300. And only an hour later I was losing my virginity, inexpertly and unexpectedly, in a bedroom of the Hotel de Paris. My instructress was at least 15 years older than myself, but in my mind she has remained always the same age, and it is I who have grown older. We met in the casino, where, seeing that I was pursued by good fortune, I had been making the bets over her shoulder, she began to lay her tokens alongside mine. If I gained that afternoon more than £300, perhaps she gained nearly 100, and at that point she stopped me, counselling prudence. I am certain there was no thought of seduction in her mind. It is true that she invited me to have tea with her at the hotel, but she had seen through my disguise better than the officials of the casino, and on the step she turned to me like a fellow conspirator and whispered, "How did you get in?" I was no more to her, I am sure, at that moment, than an adventurous child who had amused her. I didn't even pretend. I showed her my false passport, and in the bathroom of her suite she helped me to rub out the traces of make-up, which on a winter's afternoon, in the light of the lamps, had passed for genuine lines. I saw Frère Laurent disappear, wrinkle by wrinkle, in the mirror above the shelf, where lay her lotions, her eyebrow pencils, her pots of pomade. We might have been two actors sharing a dressing room. Tea at the college was served on long tables, with an urn at the end of each. Long baguettes of bread, three to a table, were set out with meagre portions of butter and jam. The china was coarse, to withstand the schoolboy clutch, and the tea strong. At the Hôtel de Paris I was astonished at the fragility of the cups, the silver teapot, the little triangular savoury sandwiches, the eclairs stuffed with cream. I lost my shyness. I spoke of my mother, of my Latin compositions, of Romeo and Juliet. Perhaps without evil intention, I quoted Catullus to show off my learning. I cannot remember now the graduation of events which led to the first long adult kiss upon the sofa. She was married, I remember she told me, to a director of the Banque de l'Indochine, and I had visions of a man ladling coins into a drawer with a brass scoop. He was at the moment on a visit to Saigon, where she suspected him of supporting a Cochinese mistress. It was not a long conversation. I was soon back at the beginning of my studies, learning a first lesson in love on a big white bed with carved pineapple bedposts in a small white room. What a lot of details I can still remember of those hours after more than 40 years. For writers, it is always said that the first 20 years of life contain the whole of experience. The rest is observation. But I think it is equally true of us all. An odd thing happened as we lay on the bed. She was finding me shy, frightened, difficult. Her fingers had no success, even her lips had failed their office, when into the room suddenly, from the port below the hill, flew a seagull. For a moment the room seemed spanned by the length of the white wings. She gave an exclamation of dismay and retreated. It was she who was scared now. I put out a hand to reassure her. The bird came to rest on a chest below a gold-framed looking-glass, and stood there regarding us on its long, stilt-like legs. It seemed as completely at home in the room as a cat, and at any moment I expected it to begin to clean its plumage. My new friend trembled a little with her fear, and suddenly I found myself as firm as a man, and I took her with such ease and confidence it was as though we had been lovers for a long time. Neither of us, during those minutes, saw the seagull go, although I shall always think that I felt the current of its wings on my back as the bird sailed out again towards the port and the bay. That was all there was, the victory in the casino, and in the white and gold room a few further triumphant minutes, the only love affair I have ever had which ended without pain or regret. For she was not even the cause of my departure from the college. That was the result of my own indiscretion in dropping into the collection bag at mass a roulette token for 5 francs which I had failed to cash. I thought I was showing generosity, for my usual contribution was 20 sous, but someone spotted me and reported me to the Dean of Studies. In the interview which followed, the last vestige of my vocation was blown away. I parted from the fathers with politeness on both sides. If they felt disappointment, I think they also felt a grudging respect. My exploit was not unworthy of the college. I had successfully concealed my small fortune under my mattress, and when they were assured that an uncle, on my father's side, had sent me my fare to England with promises of future support and a position in his firm, they relinquished me without regret. I told them that I would repay my mother's debt as soon as I had earned enough, a promise they accepted with a little embarrassment, because they obviously doubted whether it would ever be fulfilled. And I assured them, too, that I would certainly get in touch with a certain Father Thomas Capriole, S.J., at Farm Street, an old friend of the rector's, a promise which they believed I might keep. As for the notional uncle's letter, it had been a very easy one to compose. If I could deceive the casino authorities, I had no fear of failing with the fathers of the visitation, and not one of them thought of demanding to see the envelope. I set out to England by the International Express which halts at the little station below the casino. It was my last sight of the Baroque towers that had dominated my childhood, a vision of grown-up life, the palace of chance, where anything at all might happen, as I had well enough proved. 2. I would lose the proper proportions of my subject if I were to recount every stage of my progress from the casino in Monte Carlo to another casino in Port-au-Prince, where I found myself again in possession of money and in love with a woman, a coincidence no more unlikely than the encounter on the Atlantic between three people called Smith, Brown, and Jones. In the long interval I had led a hand-to-mouth existence, except for a period of peace and respectability which came with the war, and not all my occupations were of the kind to find a place in my curriculum vitae. The first job I obtained, thanks to my good knowledge of French, my Latin was singularly unhelpful, was at a small restaurant in Soho, where I served for 6 months as a waiter. I never mentioned that, nor my graduation to the Trocadero, thanks to a forged reference from Fouquet's in Paris. After some years at the Trocadero, I rose to being advisor to a small firm of educational publishers who were launching a series of French classics with notes of a scrupulously cleansing nature. That did find a place in my curriculum. Others that followed did not. Indeed, I was a little spoilt by the security of my employment during the war, when I served in the Political Intelligence Department of the Foreign Office, supervising the style of our propaganda to Vichy territory, and even had a lady novelist as my secretary. When the war was over, I wanted something better than my old life of hand to mouth, though nevertheless for some years I returned to that way of life, until at last an idea came to me south of Piccadilly, outside one of those galleries where you are likely to see a less-than-pedigree work by an obscure 17th-century Dutch painter, or perhaps it was outside a gallery a degree lower in the trade, where a taste for jovial cardinals enjoying their Friday salmon was mysteriously catered for. A middle-aged man wearing a double-breasted waistcoat and a watch-chain, a man remote, I would have said, from artistic interests, stood gazing at the pictures, and suddenly I thought I knew exactly what was passing in his mind. At Sotheby's last month, a picture fetched £100,000. A picture can represent a fortune, if one knew enough or even took a chance. And he stared very hard at some cows in a meadow, as though he were watching a little ivory ball running round a groove. It was surely the cows in the meadow at which he gazed, and not the cardinals. No one could possibly envisage the cardinals in a Sotheby sale. A week after that vision south of Piccadilly, I gambled most of what I had accumulated during more than 30 years, and invested in a trailer caravan and about 20 inexpensive prints. There was an Henri Rousseau at one end of the scale and a Jackson Pollock at the other. I hung these on one side of my van, with a record of the sums which they had fetched at auction, and the date of the sales. Then I procured a young art student, able to turn me out rapidly a number of rough pastiches, which he signed each time with a different name. I would often sit with him while he worked and try out signatures on a piece of paper. In spite of the example of Pollock and Moore, which proved that even an Anglo-Saxon name could have value, most of the names were foreign. I remember Mschloss only because his work obstinately refused to sell, and in the end we had to paint out his signature and substitute Weil. I had come to realize that the purchaser wanted, as his minimum satisfaction, to be able to pronounce a name. I got a new Weil the other day, and the nearest that even I could get to Mschloss sounded like Sludge, a name which may have caused unconscious purchaser resistance. I would drive from one provincial city to another, dragging my trailer, and come to rest in a well-to-do suburb of an industrial city. I soon realized that scientists and women were of little use to me. Scientists know too much, and few housewives love to gamble without the sight of ready cash that bingo provides. I needed gamblers, for the point of my exhibition was really this.
Here on one side of the gallery, you can see the pictures which have fetched the highest prices in the last 10 years. Would you have guessed that these cyclists by Leger, this station master by Rousseau, were worth a fortune? Here, on the other, you have a chance to spot their successors and win a fortune too. If you lose, at least you have something on your walls to talk about to your neighbors. You gain the reputation of being an advanced art patron, and it won't cost you more than... My price varied from 20 to 50 pounds, according to the neighborhood and the customer. I even once sold a two-headed woman a long way after Picasso for 100. As my young man became more skillful at his job, he would turn me out an assorted half-dozen paintings in a morning, and I paid him £2.10 for each. I was robbing nobody. With £15 for a morning's work, he was well satisfied. I was even helping young Promise, and I'm sure that many a dinner party in the provinces went better because of some outrageous challenge to good taste upon the walls. I once sold an imitation Pollock to a man who had Walt Disney dwarfs planted in his garden, around the sundial, and on either side of the crazy paving. Did I harm him? He could afford the money. He had an air of complete invulnerability, though God knows for what aberration in his sexual or business life Dopey and the other dwarfs may have compensated. It was soon after my success with Dopey's owner that I received my mother's appeal, if you could call it an appeal. It came in the shape of a picture postcard which showed the ruined citadel of the Emperor Christophe at Cap Haïtien. She wrote on the back of it her name, which was new to me, her address, and two sentences. "Feel a bit of a ruin myself. Nice to see you if you come this way." In brackets, after Maman, not recognizing her hand, I read it first, not unsuitably, as Manon, she had added Comtesse de Lascauvilliers. It had taken many months to find me. I hadn't seen my mother since one occasion in Paris in 1934, and I had not heard from her during the war. I dare say I would not have answered her invitation but for two things. It was the nearest she had ever approached to a maternal appeal, and it was really time for me to finish with the travelling art gallery, for a Sunday paper was trying to find out the source of my paintings. I had more than £1,000 in the bank. I sold the caravan, the stock, and the reproductions to a man who never read the People for £500, and I flew out to Kingston, where I looked around unsuccessfully for business opportunities, before taking another plane to Port-au-Prince. 3. Port-au-Prince was a very different place a few years ago. It was, I suppose, just as corrupt. It was even dirtier. It contained as many beggars, but at least the beggars had some hope, for the tourists were there. Now, when a man says to you, "I am starving," you believe him. I wondered what my mother was doing at the Hotel Trianon, whether she was existing there on a pension from the Count, if there had ever been a Count, or whether perhaps she was working as a housekeeper. She had been employed, when I saw her last in 1934, as a vendeuse in one of the minor couturiers. It was regarded in that pre-war period as rather a smart thing to employ an Englishwoman, so she had called herself Maggie Brown. Perhaps her married name really was Brown. For the sake of prudence, I took my bags to the El Rancho, a luxurious Americanized hotel. I wanted to be comfortable so long as my money lasted, and nobody at the airport could tell me anything about the Trianon. As I drove up between the palm trees, it looked bedraggled enough. The bougainvillea needed cutting back, and there was more grass than gravel on the drive. A few people were drinking on the balcony, among them Petit Pierre, though I was to learn soon enough that he paid for his drinks only with his pen. A young, well-dressed negro met me on the steps and asked me whether I needed a room. I said I had come to see Madame la Comtesse. I couldn't keep the double-barreled name in mind, and I had left the postcard in my hotel room. "I am afraid she is sick. Is she expecting you?" A very young American couple in bathrobes came up from the pool. The man had his arm around the girl's shoulder. "Hi, Marcel," he said. "A couple of your specials."
"Joseph," the Negro called, "2 rum punches for Mr. Nelson." He turned back to me with his inquiry.
"Tell her," I said, "that Mr. Brown is here."
"Mr. Brown?"
"Yes."
"I will see if she is awake," he hesitated.
"You said you have come from England?"
"Yes."
Joseph came out of the bar carrying the rum punches. He had no limp in those days.
"Mr. Brown from England?" Marcel asked again.
"Yes, Mr. Brown from England." He went upstairs reluctantly. The strangers on the balcony were watching me with curiosity, except for the young couple. They exchanged cherries intensely with their lips. The sun was about to set behind the great hump of Kenskov.
Petit Pierre asked, "You have come from England?"
"Yes."
"From London?"
"Yes."
"London was very cold?"
It was like an interrogation by the secret police, but in those days there were no secret police.
"It was raining when I left."
"How do you like it here, Mr. Brown?"
"I have only been here 2 hours."
The next day I had the explanation of his interest. There was a paragraph about me in the social column of the local paper.
"You're coming on fine with your backstroke," the young man said to the girl.
"Oh, chick, do you really mean it?"
"I mean it, honey."
A Negro came halfway up the steps and held out 2 hideous pieces of wood carving. Nobody paid him any attention, and he stood there, holding them out, saying nothing. I never even noticed when he went away.
"Joseph, what's for dinner?" the girl called.
A man walked round the balcony carrying a guitar. He sat down at a table near the couple and began to play. Nobody paid him any attention either. I began to feel a little awkward. I had expected a warmer welcome in my mother's home. A tall, elderly Negro with a Roman face, blackened by the soot of cities, and with hair dusted by stone, came down the stairs, followed by Marcel. He said,
"Mr. Brown?"
"Yes."
"I am Dr. Majot. Will you come into the bar for a moment?"
We went into the bar. Joseph was mixing some more rum punches for Petit Pierre and his party. A cook wearing a high white hat pushed his head through the door and retreated again when he saw Dr. Majot. A very pretty half-caste maid stopped talking to Joseph and went out onto the balcony carrying linen cloths to cover the tables.
Dr. Majot said, "You are the son of Madame la Comtesse?"
"Yes." It seemed to me that I had done nothing but answer questions since I arrived.
"Of course, your mother is anxious to see you, but I wanted first to tell you certain facts. Excitement is dangerous for her. Please, when you see her, be very gentle, undemonstrative."
I smiled. "We have never been demonstrative. What's wrong, doctor?"
"She has had a second crise cardiaque. I am surprised that she is alive. She is a very remarkable woman.
Oughtn't we to call in, perhaps?"
"You need not be afraid, Mr. Brown. The heart is my specialty. You will not find anyone more competent than I am nearer than New York. I doubt whether you will find one there."
He was not boasting, he was just explaining, for he was used to being doubted by white people.
"I was trained," he said, "under Chardin in Paris."
"No hope?"
"She can hardly survive another attack. Good night, Mr. Brown. Don't stay with her too long. I am glad you were able to come. I was afraid she might have no one to send for."
"She didn't exactly send for me."
"Perhaps one night you and I might have dinner together. I have known your mother many years. I have a great respect."
He gave me the kind of bow with which a Roman emperor might have brought an audience to an end.
He was in no way condescending. He knew his exact value.
Good night, Marcel.
To Marcel he gave no bow at all. I noticed that even Petit Pierre let him go by without greeting or question. I was ashamed at the thought that I had suggested to a man of his quality a second opinion.
Marcel said, "Will you come upstairs, Mr. Brown?"
I followed him. The walls were hung with pictures by Haitian artists, forms caught in wooden gestures among bright and heavy colors, a cockfight, a voodoo ceremony, black clouds over Kenskoff, banana trees of stormy green, the blue spears of the sugar cane, golden maize. Marcel opened the door and I went in, to the shock of my mother's hair spread over the pillow, a Haitian red which had never existed in nature. It flowed abundantly on either side of her, across the great double bed.
"My dear,"
she said, as though I had come to see her from the other side of town,
"how nice of you to look in."
I kissed her wide brow like a whitewashed wall, and a little of the white came off on my lips. I was aware of Marcel watching.
"And how is England?"
she asked, as though she were inquiring after a distant daughter-in-law for whom she did not greatly care.
"It was raining when I left."
"Your father could never stand his own climate," she remarked.
She might have passed anywhere for a woman in her late 40s, and I could see nothing of an invalid about her except a tension of the skin around her mouth, which I noticed years later in the case of the pharmaceutical traveller.
"Marcel, a chair for my son."
He reluctantly drew one from the wall, but when I sat in it, I was as far from her as ever because of the width of the bed. It was a shameless bed, built for one purpose only, with a gilt curlicued footboard more suitable to a courtesan in a historical romance than to an old woman dying. I asked her,
"And is there really a count, mother?"
She gave me a knowing smile.
"He belongs to the distant past," she said, and I could not be certain whether she intended the phrase to be his epitaph or not. "Marcel," she added, "silly boy, you can safely leave us alone. I told you, he is my son."
When the door closed, she said with complacency,
"He is absurdly jealous."
"Who is he?"
"He helps me to manage the hotel."
"He isn't the Count, by any chance?"
"Méchant,"
she replied mechanically. She had really caught from the bed, or was it from the Count, an easy, enlightened 18th-century air.
"Why should he be jealous, then?"
"Perhaps he thinks you're not really my son."
"You mean he is your lover?"
I wondered what my unknown father, whose name, or so I understood, was Brown, would have thought of his negro successor.
"Why are you smiling, my dear?"
"You are a wonderful woman, mother."
"A little luck has come my way at the end."
"You mean Marcel?"
"Oh, no. He's a good boy, that's all. I meant the hotel. It is the first real property I have ever possessed. I own it completely. There is no mortgage. Even the furniture is paid for."
"And the pictures?"
"They are for sale, of course. I take a commission."
"Was it alimony from the Count which allowed you—"
"Oh, no, nothing like that. I gain nothing from the Count except his title, and I have never checked in the Almanach de Gotha to see whether it exists. No, this was a little piece of pure good fortune. A certain Monsieur de Chaux, who lived in Port-au-Prince, was anxious about his taxes, and as I was working for him at the time, in a secretarial capacity, I allowed him to put this hotel under my name. Of course, I left him the place in my will, and as I was over 60 and he was 35, the arrangement seemed to him quite a secure one."
"He trusted you?"
"He was quite right to trust me, my dear. But he was wrong in trying to drive a Mercedes sports car on the roads that we have here. It was a lucky chance he killed only himself."
"And so you took over?"
"He would have been very happy to know of it. My dear, you can't imagine how much he detested his wife. A big fat negress without education, she could never have run the place properly. Of course, after his death, I had to alter my will. Your father, if he is still alive, might have been next of kin. By the way, I have left the Fathers of the Visitation my rosary and my missal. I was never quite happy about the manner in which I treated them, but I was very pressed for money at the time. Your father was a bit of a swine, God rest his soul. Then he is dead? I have every reason to believe it, but no proof. People live so long nowadays. Poor man.
I've been talking to your doctor.
Dr. Majot? I wish I had met him when he was younger. He's quite a man, isn't he?
He says if you keep quiet.
Here I am, lying flat in bed, she exclaimed with a knowing and pleading smile. I can do no more to please him, can I? Do you know, the dear man asked me if I would like to see a priest. I said to him, but surely, doctor, a long confession would be a little too exciting for me now, with such memories to recall. Would you mind going to the door, dear, and opening it a little way? I obeyed her. The passage was empty. From below came a chink of cutlery and a voice saying,
Oh, Chick, do you really think I could?
Thank you, dear. I just wanted to be quite certain. While you are up, would you give me my brush? Thank you again, so much. How nice it is for an old woman to have a son around. She paused. I think she expected me courteously, like a gigolo, to contradict the fact of her age.
I wanted to speak to you about my will, she went on, in a tone of slight disappointment, as she brushed and brushed her improbable and abundant hair.
Oughtn't you to rest now? The doctor told me not to stay long.
They have given you a nice room, I hope. Some of the rooms remain a little bare, for want of ready cash.
I left my bags at El Rancho.
Oh, but you must stay here, my dear. El Rancho? It wouldn't do to advertise that joint.
She used the American expression.
After all, it was what I had to tell you. This hotel will be yours one day. Only I wanted to explain. The law is so complicated, one must take precautions, that it's in the form of shares, and I have left to Marcel a third interest. He will be very useful if you treat him right, and I had to do something for the boy, hadn't I? He has been rather more than a mere manager. You understand? You are my son, so of course you understand.
I understand.
I'm so glad you are here. I didn't want any little slip. Never underestimate a Haitian lawyer when it comes to a testament. I'll tell Marcel that you'll take over the actual direction immediately. Only be tactful, that's a good boy. Marcel is very sensitive.
And you, mother, rest quiet. If you can, don't think any more about business. Try to sleep.
They say that to be dead is about as quiet as you can get. I don't see any point in my anticipating death. It lasts a long time.
I put my lips again against the whitewashed wall. She closed her eyes in an artificial gesture of love, and I tiptoed away from her to the door. When I opened it very softly, so as not to disturb her, I heard a giggle from the bed.
"You really are a son of mine," she said. "What part are you playing now?"
Those were the last words she ever said to me, and I'm not sure to this day what exactly she meant by them. I took a taxi to El Rancho and stayed there for dinner. The place was crowded, a buffet of Haitian food, carefully adapted to American tastes, was laid by the swimming pool. A bony man in a conical hat performed lightning taps upon a Haitian drum, and it was then, on my first evening, I think, that the ambition was born in me to make the Trianon successful. For the moment it was too obviously a hotel of the second class. I could imagine the small tourists' agents who included it in their round-trip programs. I doubted whether the profits could possibly satisfy both Marcel and myself.
I was determined to succeed in the biggest possible way. I would have the delight one day of sending the surplus guests uphill to El Rancho with my recommendation. And the strange thing was that my dream did come true for a short time. In 3 seasons I was able to transform the shabby place into the bizarre high spot of Port-au-Prince, and through 3 seasons I watched it die again, until now there were only the Smiths upstairs in the John Barrymore suite, and Monsieur le Ministre dead in the bathing pool. I paid my bill and took a taxi back down the hill, and entered what I had already begun to regard as my sole property. Tomorrow I would go through the accounts with Marcel. I would interview the staff, I would take control. I was already planning how best to buy Marcel out, but that would have to wait until my mother had gone on to her further destiny. They had given me a big room on the same landing as hers. The furniture, she said, had all been paid for, but the floorboards needed renewal. They bent and creaked under my feet, and the only thing of value in the room was the bed, a fine, large Victorian bed. My mother had an eye for beds, with big brass knobs. It was the first time I could remember that I had lain down to sleep in a bed I had not paid for, with breakfast included, or had not been in debt for, as was the case at the College of the Visitation. The sensation was an oddly luxurious one, and I slept well, until a jangling, hysterical, old-fashioned bell woke me while I was dreaming, God knows why, of the Boxer Rebellion. It rang and rang, and now I was reminded of a fire alarm. I put on my dressing gown and opened my door. Another door opened at the same moment from the same landing, and I saw Marcel emerge with a half-asleep look on his wide, flat negro face. He wore a pair of bright scarlet silk pajamas, and he hesitated just long enough for me to see the monogram over the pocket, an M interlaced with a Y. I wondered what the Y stood for, until I remembered that my mother's Christian name was Yvette. Were the pajamas a sentimental gift? I doubted that. More likely, the monogram was an act of defiance on my mother's part. She had very good taste, and Marcel had a fine figure to swathe in scarlet silk, and she wasn't petty enough to mind what her second-rate tourists thought. He saw me watching him, and he said, in a tone of apology, "She wants me." Then he went slowly, with what seemed reluctance, to her door. I noticed that he didn't knock before he went in. I had an odd dream when I got back to sleep, odder than the Boxer Rebellion. I was walking by the side of a lake in the moonlight, and I was dressed like an altar boy. I felt the magnetism of the still, quiet water, so that every step I took was nearer to the verge, until the uppers of my black boots were submerged. Then a wind blew, and the surge rose over the lake, like a small tidal wave. But instead of coming towards me, it went in the opposite direction, raising the water in a long retreat, so that I found I walked on dry pebbles, and that the lake existed only as a gleam on the far horizon of the desert of small stones, which wounded me through a hole in my boots. I woke to an agitation that shook the stairs and floors throughout the hotel. Madame la Comtesse, my mother, was dead. I was travelling light. My European suit was too hot to wear, and I had only a choice of gaudy sport shirts to put on for the chamber of death. The one which I chose I had bought in Jamaica. It was scarlet and covered with print taken from an 18th-century book on the economy of the islands. They had tidied my mother up by that time, and she lay on her back in a pink diaphanous nightdress, wearing an ambiguous smile of secret or even sensual satisfaction. But her powder had caked a little in the heat, and I couldn't bring myself to kiss the hard flakes. Marcel stood by the bed, dressed correctly in black, and his face dripped with tears like a black roof in a storm. I had thought of him simply as my mother's last extravagance, but it was no gigolo who said to me, in a tone of anguish, "It was not my fault, sir." I said to her again and again, "No, you're not strong enough. Wait just a little. It will be all the better if you wait." What did she say? "Nothing.
She just took off the sheets, and when I see her like that, it is always the same. He started to leave the room, shaking his head as though to get the rain out of his eyes, and then he came hurriedly back, went down on his knees by the bed, and thrust his mouth against the sheet where it was rounded by her stomach. He knelt there in his black suit, looking like some negro priest at an obscene rite. It was I, not he, who left the room, and it was I who went to the kitchen and set the servants to work again for the guests' breakfast. Even the cook was partly incapacitated by tears. And it was I who telephoned to Dr. Maggio. The telephone frequently worked in those days.
"She was a great woman," Dr. Maggio said to me later. And "I hardly knew her," was all I could say in my stupefaction.
The next day I went through her papers to find her will. She had not been very tidy. The drawers of her desk were given up indiscriminately to bills and receipts in no order that I could detect. There was a confusion even in the years. Sometimes, among a pile of laundry receipts, I came on what used to be called a billet doux. One in English, written in pencil on the back of a hotel menu, said, "Yvette, come to me tonight. I am dying slowly. I long for the coup de grace." Was it from a hotel guest? I wondered whether she had kept it for the sake of the menu or for the message, for the menu was a very special one for some July the 14th celebration. In another drawer, which otherwise contained mainly tubes of glue, drawing pins, hair slides, fountain pen refills, and paper clips, was a china pig bank. The pig was light, but it rattled all the same. I didn't want to break it open, but it seemed foolish to throw it away like that, unexamined, on the growing pile of lumber. When I cracked it apart, I found a Monte Carlo roulette token for 5 francs, like the one I had put in the chapel collection many decades ago, and a tarnishing medal attached to a ribbon. I couldn't make out what it was, but when I showed it to Dr. Maggio, he recognized it. "A medal of the resistance," he said, and it was then that he added, "She was a great woman." A medal of the resistance. I had had no communication with my mother during the years of the occupation. Had she earned it, or had she filched it, or had it been given her as a love token? Dr. Maggio had no doubt at all, but I had difficulty in thinking of my mother as a heroine, though I had no doubt at all that she could have played the part, as she could have played the grande amoureuse with the English tourist. She had convinced the fathers of the visitation of her moral rectitude, even against the dubious background of Monte Carlo. I knew very little of her, but enough to recognize an accomplished comedian. However, though her bills were untidy, there was nothing untidy about her will. It was clear and precise, signed by the Comtesse de Lascaux-Villiers and witnessed by Dr. Maggio. She had turned her hotel into a limited company and assigned a nominal share to Marcel, another to Dr. Maggio, and one to her lawyer, who was called Alexandre Dubois. She possessed the 97 other shares, as well as the 3 transfers which were neatly pinned to the document. The company owned everything to the last spoon and fork, and I was allotted 65 shares, and Marcel 33. I was to all intents the owner of the Trianon. I could begin at once to realize the dream of the night before, or only with such delay as the quick burial of my mother, a quickness entailed by the climate, presented. In these arrangements Dr. Maggio proved invaluable. She was transported that very afternoon to the small cemetery in the mountain village of Kenskov, where she was dug in with due Catholic rites among the small tombs, and Marcel wept unashamedly by the grave, which looked like a hole dug for drains in a town street, for all around were the little houses the Haitians constructed for their dead. In them, on the Feast of All Souls, they would leave their bread and wine. While the ceremonial trowels of earth were deposited on the coffin, I wondered how best I could dispose of Marcel. We had been standing in the gloom of the ink-black clouds, which always assembled over the mountain at that hour, and now they broke on us with a dash and fury
and we ran for our taxis, the priest in the lead and the gravediggers bringing up the rear. I didn't know it then, but I know now that the diggers would not have returned before the morning to cover up my mother's coffin, for no one will work in a cemetery at night unless it is a zombie who has left his grave at the command of an Ungun to labor during the dark hours. Dr. Maggio gave me dinner that night at his own home, and in addition he gave me a great deal of good advice, which I was unwise enough to discount, because I thought he might perhaps have an idea of obtaining the hotel for another client. It was the one share he possessed in my mother's company which made me suspicious, even though I held the signed transfer. He lived on the lower slopes of Pétionville in a house of 3 stories, like a miniature version of my own hotel, with its tower and its lacework balconies. In the garden grew a dry, spiky Norfolk pine, like an illustration in a Victorian novel, and the only modern object in the room, where we sat after dinner, was the telephone. It was like an oversight in a museum arrangement. The heavy drape of the scarlet curtains, the woolen cloths on the occasional tables, with baubles at each corner, the china objects on the chimney-piece that included 2 dogs with the same gentle gaze as Dr. Maggio's, the portraits of the doctor's parents, coloured photographs mounted on mauve silk in oval frames, the pleated screen in the unnecessary fireplace, spoke of another age. The literary works and a glass-fronted bookcase, Dr. Maggio kept his professional works in his consulting room, were bound in old-fashioned calf. I examined them while he was out washing his hands, as he put it in polite English. There were Les Misérables in 3 volumes, Les Mystères de Paris, with the last volume missing, several of Gaboriau's Roman Policier, Renan's Vie de Jésus, and rather surprisingly among its companions, Marx's Capital, rebound in exactly the same calf, so that it was indistinguishable at a distance from Les Misérables. The lamp at Dr. Maggio's elbow had a pink glass shade, and quite wisely, for even in those days the electric current was erratic, it was oil-burning.
"You really intend," Dr. Maggio asked me, "to take over the hotel?"
"Why not? I have a little experience of restaurant work. I can see great possibilities of improvement. My mother was not catering for the luxury trade."
"The luxury trade," Dr. Maggio repeated. "I think you can hardly depend on that here."
"Some hotels do."
"The good years will not always continue. Not very long now, and there will be the elections."
"It doesn't make much difference, does it, who wins?"
"Not to the poor, but to the tourist, perhaps."
He put a flowered saucer upon the table beside me. An ashtray would have been out of period in this room, where no one had ever smoked in the old days. He handled the saucer carefully, as though it were of precious porcelain. He was very big and very black, but he possessed great gentleness. He would never ill-treat, I felt sure, even an inanimate object such as a recalcitrant chair. Nothing can be more inconsiderate to a man of Dr. Maggio's profession than a telephone. But when it rang once during our conversation, he lifted the receiver as gently as he would have raised a patient's wrist.
"You have heard," Dr. Maggio said, "of the Emperor Christophe?"
"Of course."
"Those days could return very easily, more cruelly perhaps, and certainly more ignobly. God save us from a little Christophe." "Nobody could afford to frighten away the American tourists. You need the dollars." "When you know us better, you will realize that we don't live on money here. We live on debts. You can always afford to kill a creditor, but no one ever kills a debtor."
"Whom do you fear?"
"I fear a small country doctor. His name would mean nothing to you now. I only hope you don't see it one day stuck up in electric lights over the city. If that day comes, I promise you I shall run to cover."
It was Dr. Maggio's first mistaken prophecy. he underrated his own stubbornness or his own courage. Otherwise, I would not have been waiting for him later beside the dry swimming pool where the ex-minister lay still as a hunk of beef in a butcher's shop. "And Marcel," he asked me, "what do you propose to do with Marcel?" "I haven't decided. Tomorrow I must have a word with him. You know he owns a third of the hotel?" "You forget. I witnessed the will." It occurred to me that he might be ready to sell his shares. I have no cash, but I could probably borrow it from the bank. Dr. Maggio put his great pink palms on the knees of his black formal suit and leaned towards me as though he had a secret to convey. He said, "I would advise you to do the opposite. Let him buy your shares. Make it easy for him, and let him buy them cheap. He is a Haitian. He can live on very little. He can survive." But here again Dr. Maggio proved to be a false prophet. He saw the future of his country clearer than the fate of the individuals who composed it. I said with a smile, "Oh no, I've taken a fancy to the Trianon. You'll see. I shall stay, and I shall survive." I waited 2 days more before I spoke to Marcel, but in the interval I had a word with the bank manager. The last 2 seasons in Port-au-Prince had been good ones. I outlined my plans for the hotel, and the manager, who was a European, made no difficulty in advancing me the money I needed. The only point on which he proved difficult was the rate of repayment. "You are virtually asking me to repay in 3 years." "Yes." "Why?" "Well, you see, before that there are the elections." I had hardly seen Marcel since the funeral. Joseph, the barman, came to me for orders. The cook and the gardener came to me. Marcel had abdicated without a fight, but I noticed when I passed him on the stairs that he smelt strongly of rum, so I had a glass of it ready for him when we came together at last to talk. He listened without a word, and he accepted what I had to say without dispute. What I offered him was a lot of money in Haitian terms, and I offered it in dollars and not goods, even though it represented half the nominal value of his shares. For psychological effect, I had the money on me in $100 bills. "You had better count them," I told him, but he put the money in his pocket without checking it. "And now," I said, "if you will sign here." And he signed without reading what he signed. It was as easy as that. No scene at all. "I'll need your room," I said, "from tomorrow." Was I harsh to him? What partly influenced me was the embarrassment of dealing with my mother's lover, and it must have been awkward for him, too, to meet her son, a man much older than himself. Just before he left the room, he spoke of her. "I pretended not to hear the bell," he said, "but she rang again and again. I thought she might need something." "But she only needed you," he said. "I am ashamed." I could hardly have discussed with him the powerful influence of my mother's sexual desires. I said, "You haven't finished your rum." He drained the glass. He said, "When she was angry with me, or when she loved me, she called me, 'You big black beast.' That is what I feel now, a big black beast." He went out of the room, one buttock heavily swollen with $100 bills, and an hour later I watched him going down the drive, carrying an old cardboard suitcase. He had abandoned in his room the scarlet silk pyjamas with the monogram YM. For a week after that I heard nothing from him. I was very busy at the hotel. The only one who really knew his job was Joseph. I made him famous later for his rum punches. And I could only suppose that our guests were so used to eating badly at home, they accepted the cook's dishes as just an inseparable feature of human life. He served overcooked steaks and ice cream. I found myself living almost entirely on the grapefruit, which he found it hard to spoil. The season was nearly at an end, and I longed for the last guest to go, so that I could give the cook his quietus. Not that I knew where to find his successor. Good cooks were not easy to find in Port-au-Prince. One night I felt a strong need to forget the hotel, so I took myself to the casino. In those days, before Dr. Duvalier came to power, there were enough tourists to keep 3 roulette tables busy. You could hear the music from the nightclub below, and occasionally a woman in evening dress, tired of dancing, would bring her partner to the tables. Haitian women are the most beautiful in the world, I think, and there were faces and figures there which would have made a fortune for their owners in a Western capital. And always for me in a casino was the sense that anything might happen. Man has but one virginity to lose, and I had lost mine that winter afternoon in Monte Carlo. I had been playing for several minutes before I saw that Marcel was sitting at the same table. I would have shifted, but I had already won once en plein. I have a superstition that only a single table each night is lucky.